Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's been a long winter, hasn't it? A cold and snowy winter, almost perfect in my mind. But now it's spring, and I love that just as much. In fact, I love every season, and I think Julie Zickafoos knows what I'm talking about. At least I thought she did until I caught up on her blog entries. Joining me today to defend herself for taking the word winter in vain is Julie Zickafoos. She's watercolorist, writer, book author, and NPR commentator, and she lives on 80 acres in Appalachia, Ohio, with her spouse and two children, and apparently has had a rough winter. Julie, welcome to the show.
Hello, Ann Fisher. I am sitting here with my bare feet hanging out the window of my tower room. I just want you to know that.
Well, thank you, because I'm sitting in a studio with no windows to anywhere. But, of course, my lovely associate producer, Amy. So you blogged a lot about your winter woes.
I did. You know, there's something about that I-70 corridor that is just, it's like the devil possesses it. And every time I get on it, it turns into a skating rink, and semis just magically start careening off into the median right in front of me. So, you know, I think I had come back from Columbus. Our band,
that was a rough trip.
Yeah. We had a couple thousand pounds of music equipment. Our band had gone up to play a benefit, operative word there, benefit, for Nature Iraq, which was great for the Ohio Ornithological Society. We had a 3.5-hour white knuckle drive all the way up there on a Thursday night or a Friday night, and then we came back on Saturday.
Was it that really deep slushy snow night?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I remember that.
Nobody could go anywhere. So,
but I went out.
we got all six members of our band up there, and nobody showed up.
Oh no!
Well, some people showed up, but it was tough, you know. And then we came back on Saturday, and it was again fabulously dangerous. And I wrote that after coming back, and I also had 20 people coming over to a birthday dinner for my husband, and I had, like, enough fresh asparagus for 20 people, baby back ribs, sweet potato hash, the North Star Cafe.
Man, that sounds good. Yeah.
It was amazing. And nobody could get up my driveway, which is a quarter mile long. So I just went from one emergency to another.
Yeah, but you kind of soft pedaled. Now, that trip back, you also ran out of gas.
I did.
Which
I
just made me gasp when I read that.
I had to walk. I had to leave my kids in my car, locked into my car, and walk to a gas station. But, you know, that was okay because the gas station was pretty much right off the exit ramp. What wasn't okay was the gas can that I bought for $8.99, which had so many child-proof and child-safe features on it that it took me 25 minutes to figure out how to assemble it so I could get the gallon in my car.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, I mean, I love winter, yeah, but enough already.
Winter's so great because if you love birds, they just stand out, the ones that stick around.
Yes, they do. They do. And you know, they become your best friend if you feed them. So, yeah, you can get very, very personal with a lot of birds really fast when there's, you know, 2 feet of snow on the ground.
There was a word you used in one of the postings. You said the word chalishing.
Oh, it's hollishing.
Hollishing.
Yeah. You've got to brush up your Yiddish.
It just looks good.
It's a great word. Hollishing means to die slowly, inch by inch. And that's what I did long about, you know, late January, early February. And what it was, you know, my kids were out of school for 17 days, thanks to snow this winter. And I adore my kids. They're fabulous. But they were like hanging on me.
What do you call it? Something like
they were my succubi.
Continuum, the unbroken continuum of parenting.
Yes. It's 24 hours a day. Yep. And you know, they're like the guests who won't go away. And people who paint and write kind of like to shut themselves in the studio every now and then and just like never hear from anybody for a while. So it was a winter.
You said that you wrote that this winter is about you not having choice.
Mm-hmm.
What that means, you just couldn't jump in the car and go where you wanted to. Couldn't.
In part, yeah, because it was like your plans had to change with the weather, and the weather kind of dictated where you could go. And understand, I live 5.5 miles out of very, very windy, very icy, and almost untended road.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, thank goodness I bought a Subaru in August because that I had to have that.
Like one of those all-wheel drive things?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and it's fabulous. I've never actually gotten stuck in it, so it's just great. But, you know, you don't drive unnecessarily.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Julie Zickafoos, writer, artist, and NPR commentator. And author of Letters from Eden, A Year at Home in the Woods. And Julie, you have another book you're working on, or you've written, and you're just illustrating it now.
Yes, I'm decorating it.
Tell us about that.
Yeah,
decorating
well, it's kind of like I've set this bar really high because Letters from Eden.
Fabulous.
I was contracted to do 50 illustrations, and I gave them 153.
Wow.
So, and it's because I had this vision for the book to be like this feast. I wanted it to be the kind of book I would want to buy, which is, you know, as much visual delight as prose to read. So I'm doing that again with the next book, and it's a little harder because for Letters from Eden, I kind of emptied out my flat files. I have two enormous flat files in my studio, and I have tons and tons of illustrations from past years. For this one, I'm doing all the illustrations brand new, but I want it to look and feel like Letters from Eden, kind of like an art book that's unexpectedly fun to read.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why, you know, I'm just going to be working on it for the foreseeable future.
and it's pretty much strictly about your relationship with the birds?
It is. It is. Every chapter, every one of the 25 chapters deals with a different species of bird. And the only criterion for inclusion was, had I raised it? Had I fixed it when it was busted? Had I gotten to know it, you know, by hand feeding it? You know, something like that. So it's kind of, it's birds that I have had more than passing acquaintanceships with.
You write about your crows, the three crows. When I first read that, I thought it said cows. So I went on and I'm reading this and you're talking about the three cows that come to your window and look up at you. And I'm like, that's awful close to the house. I went back and reread that one. No, but you love your crows.
I love my crows. And, you know, wherever I live, I try to, well, it doesn't take too long. I catch the eye of the crows by putting out more than your basic bird seed. I'll put out like beef stew or an old pork roast or something like that. And it doesn't take long for crows to say, oh, look, there's the roast lady. And so you get them coming in. And then the trick is to take these supremely wary birds who are shot by so many quote unquote sportsmen around here. You know, they on a good Saturday, they'll just go out and play some crow alarm calls and set up an owl dummy and then just kill them.
Just for fun?
Yeah, for fun. And nobody eats it. And so these birds are very, very mistrustful. And so you have to win their love. And that's the challenge that I love. And now they're at the point of if I haven't laid out a treat for them on this little mound in the side yard, they will walk up under the studio window and cock their eyes at me and look at me like, my treat? And I make it something different every day. You know, it might be a donut, or it might be a piece of chicken, or it might be meat trimmings. Today they've got meat trimmings and oatmeal cookies. So.
Oh, my gosh. My stomach's growling. Now, they're distrustful from that because they're very smart.
Very, very, very smart. And they are also, I love them as a, you know, as a behaviorist, I love them because they are an animal that has a language, and they have words that they use to mean different things. And so the more I can have them around, the more I can clue into their language. Perfect example. I was lying in bed, just barely coming to consciousness, and I heard crows out in the meadow calling a distinctive call. It was, ah! Ah!
I know that call.
Yeah. It was a long, drawn-out, slightly raspy call. And
yeah.
As I listened, I thought, okay, it's not guttural enough to mean owl, and it's not rolling enough to mean cat. I think they've got a canid, and I thought, well, maybe I'll get to see a coyote. So I was just struggling up out of bed, and my son ran into the bedroom and said, Mommy, there are three crows in the yard, and there's a dog. It was the coolest moment, because I hadn't even raised my blinds, you know? I felt like Dr. Doolittle.
Yeah.
It was such a wonderful, wonderful thing. And if you're ever, here's another.
Just, was it a coyote?
It turned out to be a dog.
Okay.
It was a dog that looked very much like a coyote.
Okay.
I doubt, you know, crows may be able to distinguish the word between dog and coyote, but I'm not that good yet. but it was just a neat moment because I could, I started doing this in the early 80s when I lived on a nature preserve in Connecticut, just trying to figure out what they were saying, you know. And I got my inspiration from Ernest Thompson Seton. He had asserted in the late 1800s in his writings that crows had a language, and he even gave musical notation for the words. And so that's what I started off with, and it, boy, it's true.
You know, we were talking about doing bird calls with you next time. We couldn't get it ready for this time, but I'm convinced, and I have conviction about this. You know, the crows in my neighborhood, and I live in, you know, typical, you know, suburban neighborhood in old, a la 1967, and they go, so there's big trees.
Right.
And these crows go in, kind of routinely in the morning, go to the top of a tree somewhere in our general area and start doing that caw. And yep. I wonder, is it because the dogs are out getting their walks?
Well, you know, it's kind of hard to tell, you know, if you're not right there listening to it, what they might be talking about. You know, the one drawback about feeding crows is that they will come at first light and start cawing right on your
They
roof.
Do that.
Yeah, it's kind of like having peacocks. But, you know, the thing is that I'm always up then anyway, because once the bird song starts in the spring, I can't sleep in. So, in fact, if I need to sleep in, like if we've had a really late music thing the night before, I have to use earplugs because I listen to the birds, you know, in my sleep. So I have to just, like, put pillows over my head.
There was one morning when I was out by the Olentangy River. I live right near it. And these birds were, first there were three or four at the top of the tree, big, tall, like a big sycamore. And then as I watched over the course of about 15 minutes, crows were flying in from every direction and all landing on the same tree.
Yeah. Yeah, they probably had an owl or a hawk.
Oh, yeah, there are owls out there.
Yeah, that's mobbing behavior. Hawks. And it's really neat. I mean, one of the reasons that crows are black is because they are a highly, highly social animal. And what shows up best against a pale sky but a black bird?
Yeah.
And so when crows are mobbing something and they want to bring a bunch of other crows fast, they caw really loudly, really raucously. But more importantly, they fly straight up into the air and they make these little circles and then dives. And so any crow who can just hear the faintest hint of this ruckus going on will look and see these birds doing this behavior. And that's how they seem to magically, it's like iron filings to a magnet. They just come out of nowhere. And basically, you know, the crows from even farther away see the far crows flying in, and so it just kind of sucks them in. It's amazing how fast they can get a group.
It's like someone was ringing a bell.
Yeah.
There's a fire or something.
Exactly, exactly. And that's the whole point. It's like, come here, let's get this thing. You know, let's holler about it.
Is that what they would do? Is they would attack something then?
I actually picked up a great horned owl that had been killed by a crow.
Wow.
Yeah, it had a perfect, it was the weirdest thing. I picked it up and I noticed that it had been shot through its wrist. So that was the reason why it was on the ground.
Uh-huh.
It was emaciated, so it had been some time, probably weeks, that this thing had been trying to make a living on the ground. It was very sad.
Yeah.
But that wouldn't have necessarily killed it. And as I skinned it, I found a perfect triangular dent in the skull. And that was what killed it. And that was a blow from a crow.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to take a quick break. My guest is Julie Zicafous, author of Letters from Eden, A Year at Home in the Woods. She's an NPR commentator. You've probably heard from her. You'll hear from her again when we return. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to WOSU.org/email to sign up for one of WOSU's e-newsletters.
And good morning. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. At noon, Fresh Air will be here in a discussion with actress Amy Ryan. On The Wire, she played a cop. In The Office, she played an HR person and Michael's girlfriend. Now she co-stars in the new movie Green Zone as a reporter who is fed misinformation about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That discussion on Fresh Air at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 60 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20, a mix of sun and clouds today, a slight chance of afternoon rain, a high of 65. Rain showers are likely tonight, maybe a thunderstorm, and a low of 48. More rain on Friday, and a high of 62. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm speaking with Julie Zickafoos. She's an NPR commentator. You probably heard her. She's a writer. She's a wonderful watercolorist. And she wrote Letters from Eden, A Year at Home in the Woods. Julie, do you know what your next book's going to be called?
Well, the working title is Life Birds, but it's not one I'm real happy about because it kind of sounds like you're going out trying to find birds to put on your life list, which is something birders do. My involvement with the birds is so much more deep than that, so much more intimate than just checking off their names and moving on to the next one. So I'm trying to figure out what to call it.
Well, we've got a call right now, 614-292-8513. And, Paul, you wanted to talk about crows, so I wanted to take your call right away before we moved on.
Yes, I've lived on a farm when I was a young fella and saw many crows. And I wondered if she's ever seen a crow catch a young rabbit out in the open. How many crows pluck young robin right out of its nest?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not really pleased with crows, and I don't hold anything against anybody that wants to shoot one.
Oh, I see.
I'll take your answer off the air.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Well.
Okay, I missed the very last part. What did
he said he wouldn't hold anything against anybody that wants to shoot him.
Well, a lot of people don't, you know, and a lot of people hate blue jays, too.
Mm-hmm.
I'd point out that we're predators, too. I mean, we take baby calves right out of their stalls. So, you know, we're just crows do what we do. And I have definitely seen any time you see somebody mow a hay meadow, the crows are walking along plucking baby rabbits out of their nests, for sure. But, you know, is that good reason to hate them? Does that mean we hate hawks, too, because they eat rabbits?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think there's a place for everything, and we have there's a sharp-shinned hawk circling out over our meadow right now who nests on our property and who has been here for 3 winters, and I've watched him grow up. And he's got a nest of his own every spring on the certain corner of our property. And about every other day, he takes a cardinal. And you know what? That's fine with me. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go shoot that hawk because it's eating cardinals. We have 70 cardinals. So there's a balance here. And if something weren't eating the rabbits, you wouldn't have much in your garden.
There is, we talked about it the last time, but I don't know, something about the plovers. The Phoebes.
Uh-huh.
This time I got the fact from rereading, well, you write about Phoebes a lot, but rereading one section that they feed on houseflies.
Oh, yeah.
And that alone raised them. And now if you didn't raise them in my esteem alone, that puts them up there on a pedestal.
The Phoebes are coming in right now. I'm eagerly awaiting the first one to arrive on the place and because mid-March is right when they come. And the way they survive in March and when it's before it's really reliably warmed up is they catch house flies that are basking on the south side of our house.
I love that.
Yeah, it's great. It's really neat to see them do that. And that's why when they arrive, they're right on the deck railing, you know, and you go, wow, it's like they're saying hello. But what they're actually doing is, you know, catching the house flies.
Did you hear about the eagles, the eagle nest, the bald eagles along the Olentangy down by High Banks?
I didn't hear about that particular pair. Have you got a nest up there?
Yeah, they've just found a nest of them. And actually, they were spotted a little farther south along Olentangy, I think, by where I live. Some folks had seen them this winter, and they were probably scouting for a new place. But yeah, I mean, right here, I mean, right in the metro area.
You know, it's amazing. This has been one of my favorite things about being born when I was. I was born in 1958, and of course, DDT was in heavy use mm-hmm. and was used all through the 60s and the mid 70s. And really, the alarm started going off in the late 60s, early 70s. Rachel Carson wrote her seminal book, Silent Spring, and people started going, you know, we're just not seeing these birds. And bald eagles took it really hard.
Yeah,
because it's in their eggshells. And so I've been able to live through this recovery of this species, and I have gone from firmly believing I'd never see a bald eagle in my whole life to like now people are calling me all the time and saying, oh, there's a pair of eagles here, and there's a pair of eagles there, and there's a nest at Seneca Lake, and it's just fantastic. And I think what we're going to learn about bald eagles is that they're a lot more like crows than we think because they are not these regal, easily disturbed, you know, sentinels of the wilderness that we believe. They are opportunistic, very intelligent, and very flexible birds that can actually take a lot more proximity to humans than we have given them credit for.
Yeah, that was always my impression of them. By the way, I grew up in the same era, thinking we'll never see him again except on a coin or, you know, as the national symbol. And that was the impression as well. But it is interesting. I was very surprised to hear that they had nested so close.
Well, yeah, and it's just going to happen again and again.
Yeah.
When I go home to Richmond, Virginia, where I grew up, there is now a bald eagle nest in full view of the James River Bridge in Richmond. It's just, I remember going back after a number of years, and I was driving across a bridge. I about twisted my neck off. Well, that's a bald eagle nest, and there's a hen sitting on it. It was just so wonderful. It really came home to me that, you know, good things do happen in conservation, and, you know, birds like the bald eagle get not only, you know, get abundant, but they get delisted, and you know, it's just great.
They're Aries, I guess they call them, an eagle nest, are so gigantic.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, they can bring the tree down that they're in. If they build on them for enough years, they can just bring the tree down with their weight.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
We have a couple calls right now, 614-292-8513, if you'd like to talk with Julie Zickafoos. And Jerry, you're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning, ladies. I'm reminded of being out on my little canoe and on King Lake in the western part of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and looked up and there were two bald eagles, and then I spotted their nest on one of three little islands on this the southeast end of this lake. But did you know that the actor John Barrymore had a pet vulture?
A pet vulture?
Yes, sir. And it used to nibble food off his lips.
Ugh.
Oh, I believe it.
And the best biography of John is by Gene Fowler. I don't know if you're familiar with Fowler. He probably wrote this 50 years ago. Good night, sweet prince. But here's the story. John got sick one time, and somehow the vulture got out, and it started circling the house. And John thought it was signaling his demise. He said, "Get rid of that vulture." He gave it to the zoo.
Oh, that's great.
I just thought I'd throw a little humor in, lady.
That's pretty good, Jerry. Thanks.
I've got to tell you a story right back, Jerry.
Uh-huh.
I came back from the grocery store with a bunch of groceries, and unbeknownst to me, a chicken had rolled out of one of the bags, and it was wrapped. It was sealed in plastic.
Oh, I thought you meant a live chicken.
No. I'm not that bad.
I'm just misinterpreting today.
So this thing sat in my car in the closed garage for a week.
Oh, no.
Because I don't go to town unless I need to, you know?
Oh,
so I went looking for the chicken to make, well, it was 4 days, actually. I went looking for this chicken to make some soup, and I couldn't find it. I said, well, I know I bought this chicken. And I finally put together that the vultures that had been circling over my garage for 3 days were trying to tell me that there was a rotten chicken in my car. And I went out to the garage thinking, oh, I couldn't have left it in the car. I just couldn't have. And when I opened the garage door, the smell hit me in the face.
Oh, boy.
But the vulture, yeah, I wrote a piece about it called The Vulture's New.
Is that why you got the new car last summer?
Well, the old floor was getting pretty rank.
Thanks for your call, Jerry.
Nothing like a rank story.
Take care. You had some, several posts about Zikto.
Yes.
Your famous, I guess kind of a feeding suet type of.
Well, it's a homemade concoction that I make out of lard, peanut butter, cornmeal, flour, and rolled quick oats. And that was the old recipe, and I have been making it for well over probably 15 years. And I feed it to birds because it's a wonderful food for them in the depth of winter when they're having a tough time, and also because you can attract things like bluebirds in with it. It's a good food for insectivores like bluebirds in the winter. So you can get almost any bird that visits your feeder will eat this stuff, and you can sort of train them to come in. You heard me talking about how I train the crows. Well, I have, you know, bluebirds and cardinals and field sparrows and towhees and things like that coming in for this wonderful food. But the problem is that it's fed in excess. It's not good for them, and it took me quite a while to figure out that was true. And so I did that. I figured that out when two bluebirds in my yard who had lived all last winter on this stuff turned up lame. And I thought that was too odd to be a coincidence. So I took my 300-millimeter telephoto lens, and I photographed their feet, and darned if their feet weren't red and swollen.
Mm.
I said, well, that looks like gout. So I called my avian veterinarian back in Connecticut, who I've worked with, and who I just adore, Bob Giddings. And I said, Bob, can birds get gout? And he said, oh, yes. He said there was a pellet put out by one bird feed company that gave cockatiels gout because it was too rich. And so this is how we find this out. We do these things. We feed this stuff to our pets. And, you know, if they don't do well, we kind of look at the food. So I was actually doing this to the wild birds without meaning to or knowing.
Mm-hmm.
So what I just came up with was an improved recipe. I'm still working on it. But instead, I've substituted chick starter for the cornmeal. And chick starter is a pelleted extruded diet designed to promote growth in baby chicks. So it's high in protein and calcium. And we think that, you know, added calcium in the diet will help prevent problems like gout. But I don't know that for sure yet, but I'm still working on it.
Now, we'll post that recipe because we're going to post Julie's blog address. It's juliezikafus.blogspot.com.
Correct.
But if you want to know all the spelling of that, juliezikefoose.blogspot.com, and we'll post that on wosu.org/allsides, so you can go and get that recipe. So did you see any improvement?
Well, I haven't. I have been feeding it since Christmas, and the improved stuff, and I haven't seen any problems in the birds, but I'm not sure that I've had enough time for them to show up.
Okay.
So, you know, if they show up with problems in their feet this spring, I'm going to go back and adjust the recipe and perhaps phase out the lard altogether, because gout is caused by an excess of uric acid in the blood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the cause is purines, which are found in lard. And, you know, any rich diet is full of purines. A meat-rich diet is full of them, and it causes a excess of uric acid in your blood, which causes little crystals in your joints, and they're very painful.
Let's take a call, 614-292-8513. Glenn, thanks for waiting. You want to talk about insects in winter?
Yes, I had actually two questions, but I'm familiar with snow fleas. I've seen those before in different parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But this past winter, with all the wonderful snow we've had, I'm a cross-country skier, so I love it. I saw, over a course of two weekends, outside of Columbus in the counties, three different types of spiders crawling in the snow.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's the first I've seen those. And on this one day, I saw several other types of insects, like some flying insects.
It is incredible what lives beneath the snow and continues to be active. And you'd think that these insects would just freeze solid. You just can't even believe that they're able to survive. But, man, as soon as the snow melted off, there were all kinds of spiders running through the fields. And, you know, magically the bluebirds have deserted me because they're out foraging now. I see them out sitting on the posts in the meadow and diving down after insects. So, yeah, it's incredible how many things are able to overwinter.
Yeah, I mean, they're flying around the light out back already.
Yes.
Now, I don't know what part of the state you are residing, but did you see any of the ice formations down in the Hocking Hills this winter?
I didn't make it down there, but we have our own mini Hocking Hills in one valley on our land, and we have a magic ice cave that is just fantastic. And, in fact, about three winters ago, my friend Sheila and I were photographing these blobs and stalactites and giant icicles. And we were standing almost under one formation when it let go.
Oh, whoa.
Oh, man.
And about a ton of ice just came crashing down at our feet. And we just looked at each other and thought, well, that was a close one. So anybody who loves photographing icicles, do it off to the side.
Well, it's been a delight to talk to you. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks, Glenn. I love the wren in the warehouse story.
Oh, yes.
Only you would find a wren in a warehouse.
Yeah, I had this friend who said, an amazing bird stuff keeps happening.
Right.
Why is that? Well, you know, the whole idea is that I'm just so tuned into them that the slightest little chirp or call, and I immediately zero in on it. So bird sound is not a a background sound to me. It's almost as if I'm at a party and everybody's talking to me.
So what happened with the wren?
Oh, this was cute. It was a Saturday morning, and Bill had gotten a bee in his bonnet, and we'd had a very late night out playing in a bar the night before, but he got up at like 7 in the morning and started ripping apart our daughter's room. He wanted to paint it, and furthermore, he wanted to paint each wall a different color. So my job was to go pick out some carpet. Well, this is how he is. I call him Thumper. You know, he just, he goes. So I went to the warehouse on a Saturday morning. It was about a half hour before the thing closed, and I was going to buy a couple of remnants, one for each kid's room. And I'm poking around in the remnants, and I hear this little burp. I was like, uh-oh, that's a Carolina wren. What's a Carolina wren doing in a carpet warehouse? And sure enough, this little tiny brown bird comes buzz-bombing out of the remnants and then dives right back into him. And it's just exactly like a log, a bunch of stacked logs against the wall, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I think... And this warehouse is enormous. And I think, how am I going to get this thing out of here? I said, okay, honey, I'll get you out of here. But, you know, I got to pick out a carpet remnant. So I'm picking away. The bird flies up to a little strut in the ceiling over my head and starts going, burr, burr, burr. I said, yes, yes, I will get you out of here. It's okay. So I picked, I just grabbed the two remnants that seemed like they'd work. And I called to the salesman and I said, where's the door? How do we have a bird here? We've got to get it out. So he opened this enormous warehouse door, not in the one we were in, but in the next warehouse over. So the trick was to get the bird out of the remnant logs and into the room with the door. And it was just, he and I just kind of herded it together, herded it into the correct room, and then it hid under some pallets. And if you know how wrens behave, once they're hiding, they don't want to come out. But I just stood there and talked to it, and I said, look, we've got 10 minutes to get you out of here. And apparently it had come in on a Thursday afternoon, and this was a Saturday morning. So the thing was had been inside without food or water.
So the carpet, the guy, he knew about it?
Well, I told him. No, I said, when was the last time this door was opened?
Oh, okay.
And it had been a Thursday. So I thought, oh, this poor thing. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to it, and I just said, you've got to come out. You've got to get out of here. And that bird hopped out from under the pallet right in front of me and hopped over to the door and flew out.
Oh,
wow. It was magic. It was just magic. But I think in a situation like that, sometimes I think that we're able to exchange pictures with the animal. I think that's how they communicate. And I was sending it such a mental image of freedom and the woods that you could see right outside the door, and I was just channeling that for all I was worth to that little bird, and I felt as though it had responded. Now, maybe I'm an idiot. Maybe it looked out from under the pallet and said, oh, look, woods, which is more likely.
Well, Lord knows you can't eat carpet, you know.
Yeah,
it's
that's
right. We're going to have to take a short break. My guest is Julie Zickafoos, the writer, the artist, the NPR commentator, the author of Letters from Eden, A Year at Home in the Woods. We'll return after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Amy Ryan. On The Wire, she played a cop. In The Office, she played an HR person and Michael's girlfriend. She co-stars in the new movie Green Zone as a reporter who is fed misinformation about WMD in Iraq. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues in just a moment. Remember, you can hear more from WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Subscribe to podcasts of Arts Unscripted and reviews of the latest books, movies, local restaurants, and theater performances. Podcast stories from WOSU Arts contributors at WOSU.org/podcasts. 62 degrees in downtown Columbus, a mix of sun and clouds today. There is a slight chance of rain this afternoon and a high right around 65. Rain showers are likely tonight, a slight chance of a thunderstorm, a low of 48. For Friday, clouds and rain likely throughout the day, a high of 62. And more rain Friday night, a low of 46 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Julie Zickerfuss, the writer, the artist, the NPR commentator. And Julie, before I forget, I want you to tell us what you're up to. Tomorrow you're heading up to Cleveland.
Oh, yes. Oh, so excited about this. I've gotten asked to give the Explorer lecture in the Explorer series at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. And the fun starts at 5:30 tomorrow night, Friday, and with live music and refreshments. And I'm going to have a book signing of Letters from Eden. And then I get to tell everybody about all this crazy stuff for an hour. And I'm just really excited because my kids are going to be with me. And my 10-year-old son, Liam, is dino crazy.
Yeah.
He wears a velociraptor claw replica around his neck on a thong. Now, I don't think this should surprise anyone having listened. But I'm just so excited to see the dinosaur skeletons through his eyes.
Do you travel a lot to do these sorts of things?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I'm heading out to Oklahoma in April to go speak and give workshops at the Lesser Prairie Chicken Festival in Woodward, Oklahoma.
Wow.
And I just cannot wait. There are going to be ranch dinners and campfires, and, you know, it's just going to be neat.
It says here that you do workshops. What is that involved?
Well, one of the workshops I do I do a couple of them, actually like three. I do one on nature journaling, which is just to try to get people inspired to write down what they're seeing so that they can start putting the pieces together. And then I do one on creativity, just on sort of opening up those floodgates to your inner fountain of creativity, I guess. And then I do another one on watercolor painting, which is not particularly a hands-on thing because I find a lot of people get a lot of performance anxiety in these short classes that I'm able to give at nature festivals. So it's more sort of I'll take people through five or six paintings from start to finish and show them through, I'll take photographs of the painting as it evolves and show them how I do it.
That sounds cool.
It's really cool. It's really cool. I basically just keep a camera right next to me as I paint, and I run outside. Every time I do something significant, I run outside and take another progress photo of the painting. And it's just so cool for me to go back and see, like, the stage where I'm convinced it's just a piece of junk and why did I ever start this? And then to see me pull it back out of that, and then fix mistakes or happy accidents.
And then thank goodness you didn't trash it.
Yeah, exactly. I can almost always pull the fat out of the fire with watercolor.
Let's take a couple calls. We have some time. 614-292-8513. Jonathan, you're on the air. You have a suggestion for the title of Julie's book.
I do. Okay. My first thought was Bird Lady of Ohio. But I think you could probably just go with Bird Lady. I mean, not only is it a good, catchy title, very marketable, but it establishes presence.
Oh, Bird Lady, man, not Bird Girl.
Well, Girl, okay.
Bird Girl, I see someone with a cape and...
You know, I like Bird Girl, but somewhere in that area.
There's already a Bird Chick, so I can't use that.
Oh.
Okay, Bird Lady of Ohio.
Bird Lady of Ohio.
Sell, I promise.
Thank you so much.
My question is, since I moved here, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I put up a pretty big bird feeding station in my backyard. And I live right next to a pretty large park, so there's a lot of birds.
Yeah.
And before I put up the station and during the first year, I saw a lot of the really colorful birds. But then as the years were on, other birds started taking their place.
Okay, what are you getting now?
Well, admittedly, I've stopped now.
Oh, okay.
But I started with the black oil sunflower seeds, and then I used safflower seeds. And I went from originally mockingbirds and cardinals and blue jays and a few crows to mainly just blue jays.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I'll admit it disappointed me a little bit to not see the other great colors, particularly the cardinals. But actually, my main question isn't really that. It's more like, does mass feedings by individuals change the nature of the bird population in the area?
Lord, yes. Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I write about a great deal. And I have a chapter about cardinals, actually, in my next book. Because I think that we are inclined to think that anything that we do doesn't have an impact, doesn't really make any difference. You know, it's just. But I think that bird feeding has had a tremendous impact on bird populations in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Over my lifetime, I've seen species such as the tufted titmouse, the red-bellied woodpecker, the Carolina wren move north, and the cardinal move north in their range until they're in the southern tier of Canada now, where they had never historically ranged. And I'm almost sure that winter bird feeding has a great deal to do with that. I think there's some consensus that, you know, a lot of these so-called southern species that have been able to expand their range north, it's not just global warming going on here. I think it's that they have a steady food supply all winter.
Right.
And you know, it's really, I'm sure, if you look at any of those four species that I named, they're all seed eaters who will come to feeders.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so thank you very much.
Thanks, Jonathan. You know, Julie, you made me think of something. Yesterday was when I was out for the walk. You reminded me of it when I was reading your story about the robin. I saw a couple of them. There are lots of them around here, pretty much all the way through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a couple of them the other day. They were sort of ramming each other in the chest. They would jump up in the air,
yeah,
and then ram each other in the chest.
Yeah.
And then one of them would start following the other one like some sort of lovesick boy chasing a girl at a party.
Yeah, I love
and,
that.
And then was that mating or something?
Well, if they were clashing like that, that was probably a territorial dispute.
Oh, okay.
And you know, what you were picking up on is that neat way that robins have, they'll run several steps and then stand up straight.
I'd never seen that.
And then stop and then run some more.
But they jumped right up in the air.
Yes, and they'll jump straight up in the air and grapple with claws and wings.
Wow.
That was probably two males. And you can tell the sex of robins. The males have a darker
breast. Yeah, you know, I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
Yeah, the males have a darker breast and a black head. So just take a look. Now, see, robins migrate in single-sex flocks, and the first birds to come in are the males. The females follow later. When I start seeing female robins, I get really, really happy because that means spring is really here.
Oh.
So what you're getting now is probably robins coming through that are going to nest farther north. You know,
they
may not be resident birds. But, you know, the testosterone is flowing, and even though they may not be defending a territory right now, they're still going to squabble.
Okay. All right. Well, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't tell whether they're fighting or whether
they're
making love.
No, that wasn't lovemaking.
Okay. 614-292-8513. And Bob, you're on the air with Julie Zickafoos.
Yes. I'm wondering how a good way to get rid of crows, hundreds of crows that are roosting on a roof, usually during the cold weather. And their droppings just make it miserable on the sidewalks around there. How is the way to get rid of those crows?
You know, it's really interesting. I think every time I've been on WOSU, we've gotten pest control questions.
Well, they want to ask somebody who loves them that they'll know they're doing it humanely.
It puts me in a very, very weird position to be a huge crow fan and, you know, to be asked something like that. That's not really what I do.
I understand that.
Yeah. But, you know, a lot of people use deterrents. They use alarm calls, recorded alarm calls of the crows that will upset them. They will put lights up on the roof at night. They will put a radio up there playing anything to try to make them uncomfortable. And that's, you know, unfortunately, any bird in great concentrations can be a nuisance. And, you know, even birds that we love and the droppings can be a problem. Crows are, they're funny. They really are. And once they decide that they want to all roost together somewhere, they can be hard to deter. Have the people tried anything?
Yeah. Well, we've had spikes put on the ridge.
Okay.
We've also tried nets.
Oh, really?
Covered the roof with nets, but that doesn't help.
Is that right? It doesn't stop them?
Uh-uh.
Wow, that's interesting. I'm almost wondering about like a pole with like a long, like, you know, those Mylar wind socks with the long streamers on them. They're made of a shiny plastic material that they glitter.
Well, that's a possibility.
Yeah, I'm wondering about something like that, like a windsock kind of thing that would move. The problem with any of these deterrents is that birds acclimate to them. So you can put an owl decoy out there, and if the owl doesn't move every few minutes, they're going to realize it's fake.
Right, the owl is worthless.
Yeah, worthless, yeah. I have seen pigeons reaching, actually cuddling up to an owl decoy.
Right.
So
we have also.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, crows are, they're fairly suspicious. They're fairly neophobic, meaning they're afraid of things that they haven't seen before. So that's probably going to be your best ticket is, you know, something weird that is going to rattle them. How many birds are you talking about?
We're talking actually literally thousands.
Wow. Wow.
This is a large library roof.
And is it in the winter only?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, the crows have these communal roosts in the winter. They're actually beginning to think about nest building and mating. I heard the love rattle of a crow the other day, you know, that deep guttural cracking sort of that they do. And once you start hearing that, they're going to be pairing off and mating. So I would think your problem would disappear fairly quickly.
Well, the heavy snow took care of it for a while.
Did it? And they're back now?
I'm not really sure.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, well, my condolences.
Yeah.
Thanks for your call, Bob.
Okay, thank
Take
you.
Take care. Our next caller, Judy, has a little bit different. She doesn't really want to necessarily get rid of the sparrows to get rid of them, but you want to switch them out for the wrens, right, Judy?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. We have a box in our yard. We're here in Bexley. We get lots of nice birds.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had wrens, I think they're like little house wrens,
mm-hmm.
nesting for about 4 summers.
Nice.
But this winter, some sparrows have been hanging out inside it.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if the wrens will ever come back or what I can do to get them to nest again because we enjoy watching the babies.
Okay, that's a real easy one.
Okay.
A house wren can get in a hole that is 1 to 1.25 inches in diameter.
Okay.
A house sparrow needs 1.5-inch hole.
Oh.
You've got to just put a little piece of metal over that or something that is, or even a piece of wood that has 1 inch, maybe make it like 1.125 inches.
Okay.
And make the hole smaller, and that will exclude the sparrows, and then you'll get your wrens.
Okay, great, because I hear them. They come and check out you can hear them when they're
right.
talking to each other, looking for somewhere to nest.
Right, so, right.
Yeah.
The other trick with sparrows, I mentioned the mylar spooking thing. There's something called a sparrow spooker, which is nothing more than a little pole, like a soda straw thickness, right?
Okay.
And from the top are some long mylar strands that glitter and kind of like float around in the breeze.
Okay, and
sparrows
that'll tear
hate
them off.
Those.
Okay, and the yeah. wrens won't be afraid of that.
You know, the wrens might initially be afraid, but the sparrows really will be. So you may only need to use it until you deter the sparrows. And also, don't be afraid to haul out the sparrows' nesting material. You can tell it's house sparrow nesting material because it'll have weed heads in it, it'll have feathers and trash in it.
Okay.
And it'll be straw, and it will curl up the back of the box. So just keep hauling that out. This is not a protected species.
Okay.
The house sparrow, so you can do that. You
Great.
Can't touch the wren nest, though, because that's a native migratory bird.
Yes, and they're beautiful. We love them. So.
Yeah, I'm glad
okay.
you love them. That's cool.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks,
You're
Judy.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah, are sparrows kind of like the guppies of the bird world?
Yeah, they're not very well liked. House sparrows are not well liked because they are, you know, it'd be okay if they weren't so aggressive and if they weren't cavity nesters, but they take a very, very scarce resource, which is nesting holes that are laboriously carved out by woodpeckers and then used by a number of other, you know, very desirable native birds. And house sparrows will take those over. And the thing that they do that really makes people mad is that they will peck the heads of female bluebirds as they're trying to incubate their eggs and kill them.
Oh, geez.
They will peck the babies to death. They will throw out babies and eggs. And they're really
Yuck.
Kind of thugs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yuck. Hey, you talked a lot about the collateral wildlife at a zoo, and I've noticed that too,
mm-hmm.
particularly in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote a lot about that on a blog, I think it was, or maybe it was in your book.
No, it was the blog.
It was
yep,
in the book,
it was
okay.
It was called Collateral Wildlife.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Talk about that, because...
Yeah, one of my favorite things to do at zoos is to notice what else is using the zoo. And other than the, you know, exotic tigers and giraffes and rhinos, I really enjoy seeing how the native wildlife exploits this wonderful habitat that we've set up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went through the Columbus Zoo just photographing not only the zoo animals, which were gorgeous and well cared for, but the, you know, the house sparrows and the cottontail rabbits and the tunnels of Norway rats and the carp that were living in the waterways and in the you know, the waterfowl areas and the mm-hmm. Canada geese and the mallards that came in, because let's face it, there's a lot of food lying around in zoos, and the birds can come right in and exploit that. All kinds of animals can.
It's neat. And then you kind of morphed, I think, into a talk about the tiger,
mm-hmm.
and sort of wrapped it up with, if it wasn't for zoos.
Right.
And it was interesting because you pointed out the genetic differences between the ones that live in the wild and the ones
right.
that are in captivity. There's actually more genetic diversity.
Yeah, the Amur tiger was one of the most beautiful animals I've ever seen. The old name is Siberian tiger.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a heavily furred, really big cat. I think it's the largest felid in the world, and they have the most gorgeous male Amur tiger at the Columbus Zoo. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I did a little bit of reading after I came back, and I always do this with the blog post. I try to bone up and tell people something they might not know. And I found out to my shock that there's greater genetic diversity in the zoo population of Amur tigers than there is in the wild. And I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think there are under 1,000 Amur tigers left in the wild. Is that true?
I thought it was more like 600 or 700. But
yeah, it might have been more like 500.
Yeah.
500, 600. And there's about that many in zoos. And so really, zoos hold this precious genetic heritage that we have the potential of re-releasing into the wild populations. And it's desperately needed, because when you get such a small population of animals, inbreeding depression and interbreeding can cause very weird mutations and weaknesses to show up in the offspring.
I will kick myself if I don't ask you about your band. What do you play? What kind of music?
Okay.
Tell me all about it. I'll just kick myself.
Yeah, well, my husband Bill Thompson III, who's the editor of Birdwatchers Digest, has been in bands since he was in high school. I think the first band gig he ever had was playing an Electrolux vacuum cleaner salesman convention. And he said they played When the Saints Go Marching In 3 times because it was the only song they knew. He's come quite a ways since then. And he's a wonderful electric guitar player and vocalist, and he also plays jazz bass on Sundays with a trio in Parkersburg. Anyway, he has had bands since he was very young, and when we got together in 1992, I had been singing too with a band called the Cuckoos, which we, my great embarrassment, we only sang and played music about birds. So we had these captive audiences at nature, you know, festivals and Audubon.
A niche.
And then, you know, Bill and I got together and we got to play real, actual rock music, which was really fun. And so we started a band called the Swinging Orangutans in about 1994, 95. And we've been playing ever since with a changing cast of characters. And we now have 6 members, and we have, you know, probably the best musical lineup we've ever had. We have some amazing musicians who play with us.
Now, are you coming back to the Columbus area anytime soon?
Boy, I sure would love to. You know, anybody out there? You know, we would love to. It was really, really fun, despite the snow,
mm-hmm.
to, you know, to make it up to Columbus and play for people who hadn't heard us before. But, you know, our problem down here in the Marietta area is there are very few places that have live music. And so, you know, we have the will, but there are very few places that can accommodate a 6-piece band.
Let's see, you're also going to be, in August, you're going to be at the Bergamo Retreat Center in Dayton.
That's right.
I just want to let people know, it's a Midwest Native Plant Society 2nd annual conference.
Yes, that's going to be great fun. I really like those folks. I'm a little nervous, though, because, you know, I'm not a native plant purist. And when I was first asked to do this, I said, are you sure you want me to talk about the way I garden? I have some really awful things in my garden.
I always ask that people, are you sure you want me? But I can't imagine why they wouldn't. And Julie will be going to Cleveland tomorrow for the Explorer Series lecture, talk about letters from Eden at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. Julie Zuckerfus, thanks so much for joining me again.
Thank you. This has been great fun. I'll talk to you anytime.
I hope so. And thank you for listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories heard today on WOSU comes from the law offices of Porter Wright Morrison Arthur LLP, helping businesses and individuals solve complex legal problems throughout Ohio, across the country, and around the world. On the web at porterwright.com.